Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard. Why the big build-up?
You deserve a big build-up, Daniel.
You hyped up my entrance there, no? You know, I was here last week. I'm here most weeks. No need to get too excited.
I think I'd just forgotten, Daniel.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
You're speaking in very hushed tones. Is that because we're in a sort of boudoir-type place? Lionel, where are we?
We're in the cafe at the British Film Institute on the South Bank. You're on the leatherette sofa. We're on more of a fabric sofa. Very nice. It's almost sort of like a drawing room type of atmosphere in here, isn't there? The bookcase over there with lots of books on there. None of our books on the bookcase over there, but that's perhaps to be expected. It's a place where they revere film here rather than cycling.
I think they've got proper literature over there. We're surrounded by plants as well. So today we're going to talk about Tour of Lombardy. We're refusing this editorial decision to call it Il Lombardia. Tour of Lombardy it is. So we're going to talk about that, won by Dan Martin. We're also going to be talking about the latest woes to afflict Team Astana, who have had a second rider test positive for EPO, a second brother indeed test positive for EPO. And where that leaves them in relation to their membership of the MPCC, the Movement for Credible Cycling. We're going to be looking ahead to the Giro, the route announced today, I believe, Daniel. Daniel's been keeping a close eye on that. And we're going to answer some of your questions that you've tweeted in, some of them serious and some of them not so serious. But the Tour of Lombardy, Daniel, Dan Martin was the winner. An excellent win, his second monument after Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year. It kind of rescues a season that has promised so much for him and has been, I suppose, disappointing. He crashed in Liège-Bastogne-Liège on the final corner this year, might have been going for the win. We debated that on the podcast at the time. And then, of course, at the Giro d'Italia, which was his big grand tour this year, he crashed in the team time trial on the opening evening and he was out of the race. So I think this Tour of Lombardy probably does put a bit of a gloss on his season.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's easy to forget that that he crashed on the final corner in Lombardy last year when he was quite well placed. Yesterday's race, you know, we talked about the new route finishing again in Bergamo. I think it was the first time since 2003 that they used that finish and the old town in Bergamo, the cobbled climb. With the weather being very good, it turned out to be not a particularly selective race, and the general view was that it wasn't probably selective enough. There were about 30, 40 riders at least together going to the bottom of that final climb through the old town in Bergamo, and about 9 or 10 riders who came down the other side together and sort of contested the victory. And Martin, I mean, it reminded me a lot of just the way he went on the right hand side of the road, and the last sort of 600 meters reminded me a lot of the way Oscar Freire won the 1999 World Championships. Sort of everyone was watching each other, and Martin bolted down the right hand side of the road. And in that situation, you know, only takes a couple of seconds hesitation, and everyone sort of looks at Valverde at that point, and Martin was away. But, you know, so you look at some of the riders who are in that group, fast riders, Albasini, Valverde, Gilbert. It's kind of criminal, really, to let Martin go. Not to detract at all from his victory, but, you know, you see it time and time again, riders who they seem to play a game of kind of Russian roulette, prepared to lose the race rather than, you know, give everything to absolutely try to win it.
I mean, we've seen Martin win big races before on hilltop finishes, and that's his real strength, or at least when he's got away, it's been on a climb, as in the stage when he won at Bagnères de Bigorre in the Pyrenees. In the Tour de France last year, ultimately that was a sprint with Jakob Fuglsang, wasn't it? But this is the first time we've seen him win a big race, I think, from a small group in a sort of tactical way like that. And I thought it was impressive from the point of view that he didn't make the difference on the climb. I thought he did very well to hold on to that group on a technical, quite dangerous descent, where Sammy Sanchez, who's perhaps one of the fastest descenders in the sport, was really putting the pressure on. It was incredibly dangerous. There were sharp turns, narrow little tunnels, and he was sitting there. He claimed afterwards that he thought that maybe they didn't know he was there, and so there was even more of an element of surprise when he attacked.
Yeah, I mean, he hung right at the back, didn't he, throughout the descent. He was in last position almost until the moment where he launched his attack. And you know, he is quite a fast rider, but he's certainly not a rider that they would have been frightened of in that group. I suppose all the more impressive, it was the kind of move that riders make when they're in when they're full of confidence in a rich vein of form, perhaps already won some big races in the year. That wasn't the position that Martin was in. He was almost, he'd had a good season, but in a way needed to sort of save his season, yet showed that kind of clinical, very cool head that you know, you need in the in that situation in major one day races. I mean, he's not a rider that wins an awful lot. I think yesterday was his 14th win of his career, but when he wins, he certainly wins big.
Have you seen Lionel, Daniel? Where's Lionel? Is he still here?
Well, I'm letting you two get on with it because I didn't see the Tour of Lombardy yesterday or on Sunday because I was riding my bike myself.
Oh, very nice.
What a strange concept.
But you know what happened, Lionel. We should actually mention Alejandro Valverde, second again. What a season he has had! Really extraordinary. Now, Alejandro Valverde does divide people because he's somebody who has served a doping ban in the past, having been involved in Operation Puerto and sort of denied it for a long time, and eventually was snared and banned. He's come back, and this has probably been his best season since he came back. Albeit there perhaps haven't been the major wins, but just. There have been wins, but not, you know, monuments or grand tours. But just for the level of consistency that he's shown from February to now, the number of podium placings he's had, he was, I think he ended up fourth at the Tour de France, didn't he? But he was on the podium at the Vuelta. There he's on the podium again. He was on the podium at the World Championships last week. An incredible level of consistency.
Yeah, and considering he's well into his mid-30s now, approaching his late 30s, I think now... it is the kind of autumn of his career, but he's still delivering huge results for Movistar, and he's still kind of he's not going away, and so Nairo Quintana, who you would think would be their leader for the Tour de France next year, is still having to kind of wait to assume kind of outright leadership of the Movistar team. So Valverde, he's reliable for them in pretty much any race, any one day race, on the podium, as you say, at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, again there at the Tour of Lombardy, World Championships. When the biggest races come around, he will always be there, and he's not necessarily got the explosiveness that he's had in the past to pull off the wins, but he's you know, he's good for the top three, top five every time.
Some other notable performances: Tim Wellens really had a good go on the final climb, and I thought that was a great attack. It was Philip Gilbert that sort of nullified it a bit. Tom Dumoulin crashed quite heavily towards the end, but I was surprised to see him still there. You know, he's a rider who's having a great end of season and still very young and a great prospect, and a big rider and a good time trialist. Obviously, he was third at the World Championships, so to see him at the end of a race like Lombardy was quite impressive. Your friend Thibaut Pinot was still there at that point as well, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Dumoulin was there, I think, underlines what I said earlier, that the race, the route probably wasn't quite selective enough. There was a huge, I think about 100 kilometres or more in the middle of the race where there were no climbs whatsoever. And even those final climbs around Bergamo there, you know, good road surface, quite rolling. You know, there weren't too many significant attacks on there. Contador tried to break it a couple of times, wasn't able to do so. And I think they might... RCS might look at the route again next year, and you know, there are an awful lot of options around Bergamo. Even if they want to finish the race there, they could probably go over something a bit harder. Although, you know, that finish through the old town has the potential, I think, to be one of the, well, probably the most iconic finish of a monument apart from aside from Roubaix, because it is very sort of visually striking.
And it did inspire some interesting racing, a bit like Milan-San Remo, where you've got the climb followed by a descent. It kind of requires a different skill set, doesn't it? And that group that we saw at the end, the six or seven riders who were there, it was a very selective group. Rodriguez was there as well, Philip Gilbert, Albacini was there. You know, it was a very, very select group of top riders who were there, and any one of them could have won.
What about Daniel Martin, though? Because he's obviously the bona fide Irishman, so he's up there, won two monuments now, got a long way to go to close down Sean Kelly's record of monument wins. Completely different type of rider, not really a classics type rider, but he does seem to have more success in one-day races and when he targets a particular stage of a Grand Tour, as he did in the Pyrenees in the Tour. Inevitably, there'll be a lot of talk next year about him going for the overall classification again, in whether it be the Giro or the Tour. It seems to me that actually he's more at home when he's got the opportunity to race hard on a given day and sort of execute some kind of plan, some kind of strategy, rather than having to be that consistent, dogged, hang-in-there performer over sort of 2-3 weeks.
I mean, we're obsessed, aren't we, by the Grand Tours, and when is somebody going to target the general classification of a Grand Tour? Why doesn't, you know, as if that's all that really counts and matters. I think that obsession has cost Nicholas Roach some of the best years of his career, because I think he could have been winning one-day races, classics, and there's a guy so versatile. He was up there in bunch sprints at the start of his career, and I think that's something that he could and should have done. I think Dan Martin's being pragmatic and sensible. He says he prefers one-day races. He seems to be better at them. He's 28 now. These are the prime years of his career. Why, you know, put all your eggs in the Tour de France basket or Giro or whatever? I mean, it was interesting this year that after he crashed out the Giro, there was talk of him going to the Tour. I think he was fit enough physically, but he didn't want to do it. He was really... Was it Ned Bolting or somebody, one of our friends of the podcast, certainly heard, spent some time with his father, and it was obvious in the immediate aftermath of him crashing out the Giro that he had no intention of going to the Tour de France at all. So why not just accept the fact that he's a great one-day rider and embrace that, and have him embrace that as well, and rather than chase top six in a Grand Tour?
I think he deserves great credit for that, in the same way that certain riders, the more intelligent riders, realise early in their career that they are destined to be domestiques and not team leaders, and go on to carve out very good careers in that role. I think Dan Martin, I think he took his cue really from a ninth place, I think, in his first Tour of Lombardy, and that was a bit of a eureka moment for him. He realised that he really could have a future in one-day races, and you know, in spite of having won the Route du Sud very early in his career and you know, done very well as an amateur in mountainous races, and you know, he could easily have been railroaded towards Grand Tours, and I think he's been very smart and also realistic about the fact that, and I think, well, we've called him fragile in the past, or various people have called him fragile sort of physically. He's had some health problems, he's had injury problems, which, you know, seems to have been, well, on the whole, resolved. Certainly he had a sinus issue, an allergy issue that's been resolved. But I think he still probably has a tendency to have one or two problems over 3 weeks. He didn't at the Vuelta, no significant problems this year, and finished seventh. But again, that's something you have to analyse as a rider and be realistic about. If you find it hard to maintain concentration, maintain health, maintain fitness over 21 days, and on the other hand, you do have this ability in one-day races, then, you know, perhaps you're better served becoming more of a classics rider, which is what he's done.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So you're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter @cycling_podcast. We're on Facebook as well. And we have our own website, cyclingpodcast.com, where I think you'll find an archive of previous podcasts, all the previous podcasts, just about, if you look hard enough.
And don't forget, you can subscribe on iTunes as well, so that then the podcasts come directly to your phone or other device.
I like the sound of that. So let's do a few of the questions that we got on Twitter before we discuss. We're going to discuss Sky's new signings, we're going to discuss the Giro, and we're going to discuss Astana. But Kijay asks, obvious, but where does Peter Sagan fit into the Tinkoff plans as far as Sagan's Grand Tour is concerned? Actually, we talked about that a little bit last week, didn't we? So we might refer you to last week's podcast about Peter Sagan, who is becoming a little bit of an enigma, perhaps. Julian Allen asks, could there be the equivalent of the KP, that's the Kevin Peterson story, anywhere in cycling? Do senior riders, director sportifs, bosses, rule out of fear? Oh, like Tinkoff springs to mind, but any other thoughts on that? Where Kevin Peterson is, obviously his autobiography is coming out very soon, and he's stirring the pot a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I think what he's referring to there, the person asking the question, is whether there are sort of simmering rivalries that, or dressing room splits that fester away in cycling the way they perhaps do in other sports. In other sports, they tend to come out periodically, surprisingly, when people have a book out.
Just a coincidence.
It's just a coincidence, of course. I think the difference with cycling is that contracts are so much shorter, and riders are more reluctant to kind of be seen to be troublemakers, be seen to be the sort of people that couldn't fit into a team. And so rivalries and that kind of thing doesn't tend to come out in quite the same way.
Although not so much between writers, but Philippe Gilbert at BMC supposedly didn't get on with Jean Lalong, who was the DS, and it was Lalong that left after the tour, and almost at exactly the same time Gilbert signed a new 3-year contract. So there are definitely sometimes issues, I think.
Wouldn't feel too sorry for Lalong. He's got himself a cushy new job in Qatar.
Okay, won't feel too sorry for him then.
I mean, just generally, I think the age of the autocratic direct sportif is, I wouldn't say it's over, but certainly when I started covering the sport, there were a lot of quite sort of, I would say, dictatorial direct sportifs. Manolo Saez was certainly one. For Once,
who's back?
Yes,
Manolo Saez.
Continental team. Giancarlo Ferretti was certainly another, the Iron Sergeant, as Faron used to be known as. And I mean, Vincent Lavenue at AG2R has a reputation as a bit of a firebrand, although he has taken a back step, really. And I think that there is a sort of figure now, the team manager or the team principal, which, you know, Dave Brailsford is one, Bjarne Riis is another, and they have less
Bob
to
Stapleton's
do...
Bob Stapleton sort of pioneered that role, didn't he? Yeah. Bob Stapleton carved it out.
Yeah, and they have less to do with the day-to-day running of the team, and, you know, then they don't usually act as direct sportives in races, and so I think there's less latitude for them to sort of rule with an iron fist than there was in days gone by.
So Simone Warner asks, tips from each of you re-breakthrough riders next season. Daniel?
I think it'll be a big year for young Belgians, not young Frenchmen, young Belgians. I think three names that stand out. Tim Wellens has really already had his breakthrough this year, won the Eneco Tour and was extremely good yesterday in Lombardy. I think Loic Vliegen, who's going to ride for BMC next year, has been very impressive in the amateur ranks this year. And I think Louis Vervica, as well, was extremely good in the Tour de l'Avenir, very, very good climber. Periodically, we hear young Belgians heralded as the next Belgian winner of the Tour de France. Of course, last Belgian winner was Lucien Van Impe in 1976. But Vervaeke is certainly someone who seems to have considerable stage race pedigree.
Yeah, I was going to say Tim Wellens, actually. I know he won the Eneco Tour. He was fourth in the Tour of Lombardy. But two kind of more general observers of cycling, probably not a name yet that they will have come across until he does something in one of the big classics in the spring or in one of the Grand Tours. But I think he'll have a big year. And then there's another one at Amiga Pharma Quickstep, Peter Seri, who looks pretty handy. I mean, he was up there in the results in Lombardy, had a few decent results. Is this his second year as a pro already?
Yeah, he's been around for a while. The one thing about, not to contradict you, Lionel, but Lombardy, you often see now with Lombardy, there are so many riders there who don't seem to be particularly motivated and tired that young riders seem to do surprisingly well at Lombardy. Davide Vellella for Cannondale is another very promising young rider, but he rode very, very well yesterday, finished I think about 15th, 16th. But yeah, Seri did have a good ride yesterday, certainly.
Yeah, it's the kind of race where people can have a good result. It's kind of the Olivier Zorg syndrome, isn't it?
I saw Seri chasing to get back on. He was quite close to the Omega Pharma Quickstep car at the time.
Clearly got a lot of know-how then.
I think he was just collecting bottles or something, but he appeared back in the bunch not long after that.
Just on Omega Pharma Quickstep and Seri and young riders who might emerge next year, I think we've already seen Julien Alaphilippe do very well in the second half of this year. I think it'll be a big year for him. And just one more name. I forgot, Alexis Goujard of AG2R La Mondiale, a big sort of beefy kind of Cancellara type rider who might win some prologues, I think, next year.
Assistant Commissar. I'll mention a couple of MTN Quebec riders because I've just done a feature about them for a South African magazine, and they're shaping up to be a very interesting team next season. They've added Steve Cummings in the last week or so to a real roster of talented, slightly enigmatic riders. Matt Goss, Edvald Boasenhagen, Theo Bos, Tyler Farrar, lots of fast riders, lots of riders who could potentially win races if they find their mojo again. And I spoke to Douglas Ryder, the team principal, and you know, an amazing sort of enthusiast. You can sort of feel he's got very infectious enthusiasm for what he's doing, and you can imagine that he might have a galvanising effect on some of these riders. But he did rave about a couple of the younger riders. He did point out that the team remains 60% African, and it will certainly never go below 50% African, he said. But Louis Menchez is a rider who we know already quite well. He's medalled in the under-23 World Championships. He rode well again this year. He was away on his own on the final lap. He was fifth on stage for the Tour of Spain, the one that was won by rider Hejidal. So we know a little bit about him, but he's still only 21 and clearly very talented, good climber. And the Eritrean, Merhawi Kudus, if that's how you pronounce his name, Merhawi Kudus, he's only 20, and he was fifth at the Route du Sud this year, which was won by Nicolas Roach, with Valverde and Michael Rogers also up there, second and third. So to finish fifth in that sort of company is impressive, only 20 years old. So there's a few of them, though, that are coming through now, finally starting to really show what they're capable of on the European stage. So I think that's quite an exciting team to look at for next year. I think our next listener question leads quite well into the next talking point. Rob Harper asks, does the MPCC, that's the Movement for Credible Cycling, serve a purpose in cycling, given that there have been more positives from MPCC teams than the others? Very good point. So the MPCC is a voluntary group of teams who have signed up to sort of extra anti-doping clauses, conditions. They have a voluntary code of, say, withdrawing riders from races if their cortisol levels are skew-whiff, as Chris Horner's were before the Vuelta, and so Lamprey withdrew him from the race. There are very high-profile teams who are not part of the MPCC, including Team Sky, Tinkoff, Saxo, BMC, Omega Pharma, Quickstep, from memory. Dave Brailsford spoke to us about why Team Sky are not members of the MPCC for our special interview with him on the eve of the Tour de France. So you'll go back, you'll find the Dave Brailsford special, which came out the night before the Tour began. He was very interesting in why they're not members. It's become a hot topic again because Astana have had a second rider, Maxim Iglinski, test positive for EPO just a couple of weeks after his brother Valentin Iglinski tested positive for EPO. Maxim is the far better known of the two riders, with a much better palmarès. He won Liège-Bastogne-Liège in 2012. He was a member of Vincenzo Nibali's Tour de France winning team this year. And in fact, someone else asks whether his positive puts a cloud over Nibali's win, and whether we should doubt Nibali's win on the basis that one of his teammates has tested positive for EPO. But it really has probably more than anything highlighted the shortcomings of this voluntary code that teams have signed up for, because one of the stipulations is that teams, if they have two positive tests, they must withdraw from racing for 8 days. As we speak, Astana have not done that. They rode the Tour of Lombardy. Fabio Aru was quite aggressive on the final climb. He certainly fancied his chances in that race. And although there are rumours that Maxim Iglinski is going to confess, as Valentin did, as we speak, he's not done so. And if he does, they will be bound by the MPCC rules to impose an 8-day ban on themselves. On the other hand, they might just carry on. They've got this race in Kazakhstan coming up on Sunday, which is very important politically for the team, and for Vinokurov, who's the head of the team. But, I mean, what do you make of it all, Daniel? I mean, does it just, more than anything, expose how toothless and how ineffective a voluntary group like the MPCC is?
Well, I think it certainly will do if the MPCC don't take action and expel Astana if they perceive them to have, well, not just infringed the rules, but sort of disingenuously engineered the rule, yeah, to their advantage. I think the problem with the MPCC is that it serves different purposes for different teams. I think the founding members of it did join for the right reasons, and you know, at the time, I think it was in 2007, was it founded? More or less when the Rasmussen saga was breaking, and you know, they wanted to impose a more stringent rules on themselves. They saw the UCI's rules as inadequate on things like cortisone use. But subsequently, teams have come along who have kind of used the MPCC as a cloak of credibility, and you know,
it's a PR exercise.
Yeah, PR exercise, and that appears to have been the case with Astana. Whether Astana should ever have been accepted as members on the MPCC is a moot point, given that their team principal Alexander Vinokurov is someone who's served doping bans in the past, never spoken very convincingly about anti-doping signed riders with dubious reputations. So I think the sort of entrance criteria needs to be reviewed before anything else. And I think it will be interesting to see what happens in the next few days, whether they take any action, because really it's not just Astana's credibility that's at stake at the moment, it's that of the whole MPCC.
Well, it is, but you make the point about expelling Astana from the MPCC, but if they did that, they'd actually be in a better position, because then they wouldn't be bound by this regulation that says they have to withdraw from racing. So really, for a team like Astana, who's had these couple of positives and are run by Alexander Vinokurov, who's served a ban and has come back and really has just not really addressed the issue of doping particularly convincingly at all, given his history. I mean, we all remember the Tour de France and the kind of slowly gathering questions about Astana and whether Vincenzo Nibali could be trusted and relied upon to be seen as a clean winner of the Tour de France. I mean, I just remember the rest day where the futility, really, of asking Alexander Vinokurov for his opinion on doping, his stance on doping. I mean, you can go back and listen to it in the podcast from that second rest day, I think it was, during
first,
the tour.
Yeah,
the first was it the first rest day? Yeah, in Besançon. Vinokurov basically said that his doctor has told him that the team could be run without doping and that they were a clean team, and that's basically, you know, it's a statement that is pretty much hollow, really, because clearly that's not actually been the case. Whether Iglinski has been off freelancing, they clearly are not. They don't have a strong enough handle on what's going on inside the team, and as we found out, two of their riders have been doping.
I guess EPO is a surprise. You know, that is, I guess, almost regarded as an old school drug in a way. Neil Rogers wrote a quite a good analysis piece on Velo News, and he did flash back to the spring of 2012 when Iglinski won Liège-Bastogne-Liège ahead of Vincenzo Nibali. Nibali had escaped and looked like he was heading for the win, and Iglinski sort of shot out the very small group of chasers and won the race. Quite a surprise, I think. And Enrico Gasparotto the previous week had won the Amstel Gold Race, also an Astana rider, also a surprise, and he was third in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, in fact, as well. So I think there were eyebrows raised at the time about those performances by the Astana team in those particularly hard races, and races, especially Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which do have pretty checkered histories in terms of riders who've subsequently been embroiled in doping scandals. Not to say that Iglinski's win at the time was drug-fueled, but inevitably, when somebody tests positive, you do look at their entire career in a different light and with questions that you perhaps didn't have before.
Well, yeah, you do. I mean, you know, the sport, it's still relatively recently that Alexander Vinokurov was being hauled out of the Tour de France and banned himself. I mean, it's only 7 years ago that he was winning stages of the Tour with his knees practically unable to bend, and found to have been blood doping, completely unrepentant about that. And let's not forget, you know, he was Olympic champion 2 years ago, and now he's running what is a hugely significant team in the context of Kazakhstan
and those,
sport.
And those two, the Iglinski brothers, are of course Kazakh riders, which you imagine is of even more sort of fundamental concern in terms of how that team is run. The Kazakh riders are, you know, important to that team. As Chris Baldwin said on his interview with the podcast which we played just after this year's Tour de France, Chris Baldwin is the American PR man for Astana, and we'll certainly get him back on the podcast at the earliest opportunity, I think. He explained just how central the Astana professional cycling team is to, you know, wider Kazakh initiatives.
And, you know, let's not underestimate how important Astana's money and Astana's support of the team has been to cycling in general and to the UCI. And this is the problem with the current system, where people are effectively paying for licenses, and the UCI is absolutely desperate to have anyone, any sponsor, will stump up several million euros. I mean, forgetting about the MPCC for a minute, you know, because we can ask questions as well about Vinokourov and the Liège-Bastogne-Liège that he won, and fairly persuasive evidence about him having, or money having changed hands between him and Kolobnev. You know, that surely should disqualify them immediately from the MPCC, if, you know, we're going to lend any credence to that evidence, which, as I say, was quite powerful. But the same applies to the UCI and that team's World Tour license. But, you know, that question has never really been seriously considered, I don't think.
I mean, Jonathan Votter has made the point on Twitter that if he had two riders test positive for EPO, he would consider fair treatment for himself to be fired and banned for life. He was asked by people on Twitter whether he was saying that that's what should happen to Alexander Vinokourov, and he wouldn't be drawn on that. He was just saying that in his case, as somebody who is a confessed former doper himself, to oversee a team that professes to be anti-doping, have, you know, two EPO positives, it really is a terrible indictment of Vinokourov's management and all his words. Should we end this segment on a slight light note? Do you want to have something
just
else?
To add? And this is something I discussed with Marcel Kittel recently. I think he went on record once as saying that he would never ride for a team like Astana because of their association with Vinokourov. And he sort of tempered that statement slightly. I think he's more conscious of his position in the sport now and the attention that people pay to everything he says. But he said that, you know, as riders, they feel powerless and they don't feel as though, you know, they, by making sort of pronouncements like he did, they're only causing trouble for themselves. However, it was quite clear from what Kittel said that he thinks that the UCI should really show a firmer hand on issues like this, and they should be the ones dealing with precisely that question I asked a few minutes ago. You know, is there a place for a team managed by Alexander Vinokourov with not just one blot on his copybook, but several?
Yeah, and in terms of does it cast a shadow over Nibali's win, it does a little bit, and I think the onus is now on Nibali to come out and condemn very forcefully. I mean, Daniel's huffing at that, but he's in quite a difficult position. He's riding the two of Almaty who are bidding for the 2022 Winter Olympics as well, and this event is quite an important showcase for that area and to prove that they can hold a big event. There have been sort of tensions between Nibali and his team all year, and differences of, you know, from the national champion's jersey to, you know, unnecessary hunting trips to Kazakhstan. You do get this sense of some friction there between, and I you know, judging from a couple of tweets again that Nibali put out over the weekend, which has been his only comment so far on the case of the Iglinskis, he sort of suggested, he hinted that, you know, he was extremely unhappy about what happened. It's not his responsibility that a teammate, as you suggested earlier, Daniel, might have acted entirely on his own accord. But nevertheless, the problem is that if you're the winner of the tour, you have to sort of go the extra yard, I think.
I think you do, but I think also that this highlights the point, and going back to the question about Kevin Peterson's autobiography and the kind of powerlessness of the riders that Daniel mentioned, even the biggest name riders, and we're talking about Marcel Kittel a second ago, Vincenzo Nibali, if they stick their heads up above the parapet and make a controversial statement or some kind of statement, they find themselves in a very tricky position. And I think one of the big problems for professional cyclists, not only is it a relatively short career and their contracts are short-ish, you know, even the top stars only really sign a 3 or 4 year contract at a time, so circumstances can change an awful lot in a short period of time, that the issue they have is that they are effectively, Nibali finds himself effectively riding around as an advocate and de facto spokesman for Kazakhstan and all of those companies that are on the names that are on the side of the bus, and their oil interests and other energy interests and gas and the sort of aggrandizement of Kazakhstan as a nation. That's the whole point of that team. The team exists as part of this Kazakh bid to become a major player in the sort of world economy and politics. And so for Nibali to stand up and condemn a Kazakh rider who's basically part of the tour-winning team. Yeah. He's in an impossible position.
He is in a difficult position. And I should say that when I say that it casts a shadow over his win, I don't mean in the sense that we now think that Nibali was doping. That's not what I mean at all. I don't think it follows that somebody who finished further down the field in a supporting role, because he was doping, the other guys who finished above him were doping. That is an assumption that some people jump to, and I think that is massively flawed. I mean, Nibali was obviously tested throughout the tour. He's subject to far more stringent controls than a rider like Iglinski at the tour. But just in terms of the perception, I think it's a slight problem.
And maybe it's time, I sort of abdicated all responsibility from the likes of Kittel just a moment ago, but maybe it's time for riders to be a bit more proactive and their managers to be a bit more proactive and have clauses written into their contracts whereby, if two riders test positive on their team, then that gives them a get-out clause from the team in question. Because, certainly a rider in Nibali's position, he would have no problem, even now at this stage of the season, he would have no problem, I think, probably matching his salary elsewhere. Mm.
He's all right. But, I mean, if we talk all the time about cycling being a team sport, especially at the Tour de France, and Iglinski did play an important role for Nibali in athletics. If a member of the relay squad tests positive, everybody hands their medals back. Should there be penalties for the team? Should there be? Certainly, I could see the team prize being rescinded in the event of a positive test. But should there also be a penalty for the guy that wins? I think that would be unfair and perhaps unjust. But nevertheless, he tested positive for EPO just a few days after the tour finished. This suggests that he may have been artificially assisted in his duties helping Nibali win the tour.
Just the last point on that, the big problem is Vinokourov has suffered very little for his doping, and so the message coming from the top is virtually non-existent. So it's all very well saying Iglinski's salary has gone into the bank for the first 6 months of the year. Who's to say what the arrangement is, whether he'll be, will he be cast out, will there still be a place for him in the Astana organisation once he's served a ban? All of these questions come up when somebody tests positive. Really, we're not any closer to getting to the main point, which is that Vinokourov has not really demonstrated that he is a fit and proper person to run a top professional cycling team. And I think if the UCI had some kind of qualifying criteria and a code of conduct for owners, managers, then Vinokourov would have fallen foul of it so far. But the money speaks more powerfully. And as Daniel says, if Astana are coming in and spending tens of millions of euros, then that's a powerful position for them to be in.
Just to wrap this section up, then finish with a few more very quick fire readers, listeners questions. Nugget asks, is Lionel Burney his usual cheerful self again on this latest podcast? I can answer that. Yes. James Kelly, can Richard Moore finally pronounce Strad Bianchi correctly, or will Free Boss finally call him on it? The latter. And Alan Foster asks, what hair products do you all use? I don't use anything. I'm completely natural. Lionel?
Brasso for that extra shine.
I suspect Daniel's the expert on this.
Nothing at the moment. I've got
glossy mane is all natural.
It's not that glossy, but I've got an appointment with my hairdresser. He's coming to my house, as you know, Richard.
Hang on, is that why you have to leave early?
Yeah,
oh, that's that's an unacceptable reason to leave early. This is Julian Assange's hairdresser.
I think he's at the Venezuelan embassy as we speak.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Okay, so a quick final segment of this week's Telegraph Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore, I'm with Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb. And Lionel, you were going to talk a little bit about Team Sky's five new recruits, possibly six new recruits, we think.
Well, yeah, they announced five last week. That may not be the end of their recruitment. We suspect, are we going to suspect publicly that Elia Viviani is going there as well? I think we've all heard that independently of one another. So Sky are ringing the changes, really, because for all of those riders that are coming in, somebody will have to leave. There may have been a couple of with departures from Sky. But it looks like a solid set of recruitment to me. They've kind of covered every base there, really. They've gone for Nicolas Roach, Wout Poels, who used to be at Vacansoleil, Leopold Koenig, seventh in the Tour de France, Scotland's Andy Fenn. Who also started as a young rider with the Welin Wheelers, which is close to where I live. So I'm claiming him as well, Richard. And the last of those five, Lars Petter Nordhaug, who's going back to Sky after a couple of not entirely happy years at Belkin, and before that they were Rabobank. So they've gone for you look at Nordhaug going to give them some punch in the Ardennes Classics. Richard, you mentioned about Nicolas Roach perhaps being a rider who might have more joy in one day races if he were to concentrate on those. Perhaps a move to Sky will enable him to do that, because whether or not he's going to just slot into Sky's Grand Tour lineups and play the same sort of role that he did for Tinkoff Saxo this year, I'm not so sure. I think he's got greater ambitions for himself than that. And then Andy Fenn, who kind of proves the point that if you're a young, talented British rider, you don't necessarily have to go to Sky straight away. You can go off and learn for a couple of years at another team, and that the door will still be open to you.
He's fallen through the cracks a bit, though, at Omega Pharma Quickstep. I mean, he's a big, strong rider who should, you know, a former winner of Junior Paris-Roubaix, should be quite a, you know, an Ian Stannard type rider in those Belgian Flanders type classics, and I expect him to have a bit more chance at Team Sky, perhaps in support of Stannard. Edvald Boasenhagen is away now, of course, so there's perhaps a bit of opportunity there for him.
You talked about the Ardennes Classics lineup. That was obviously it was a disastrous area for Sky this year. So it was one of the sort of low points of their history as a team, the Ardennes Classics this year. I can see Nordhaug and Roach offering, giving them slightly more than what they've had in those races, but they're not in my mind potential winners of Flesh, Liège, and Amstel, are they? For you, I mean, for a team as high profile as Sky, a team with designs on sort of the top spot in the world.
The Amstel rank. Gold Race is an Ardennes Classic now, is it, Daniel? Wow. I was pulled up for that earlier this year.
No, it's not exactly, but you know what I mean.
Hypocrite.
I think Nordhaug's good. I think although it's not an Ardennes Classic, I think he could win Amstel Gold, certainly. Yeah, I think he's good enough. You know, he's been up there in you know, the latter stages. I think he could.
He's a top 10 rider at best, personally. But
fight. But yeah, I mean, Nicolas Roach is as much as he's an asset to Team Sky, he's also a loss to Tinkoff Saxo. He was a good rider for them at the Tour this year after Contador pulled out, quite a good foil for Rafał Majka and others in their stage wins. You know, and he's been a strong rider for years, very, very versatile, as I said earlier, great all-rounder. And I think the depth of loss to Tinkoff Saxo was indicated by Oleg Tinkoff's tweets on his departure. He felt that he was asking for too much money, him and his agent, Andrew McQuaid, were asking for too much money. But, you know, I mean, you're worth what people are prepared to pay you. And I imagine he's on a decent salary at Team Sky, but perhaps not, you know, significantly more than what he was on at Tinkoff Saxo. And there was a little bit of sour grapes there, perhaps, and a little bit of an indication that he actually is a serious loss to Tinkoff Saxo. And you know, that kind of intervention by Tinkoff will surely only make him more determined when it comes to the Tour next year to win the race on behalf of Chris Froome over Contador and his old teammates.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboom, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Shall we move on to our next topic? I think we're going to talk about the Giro d'Italia and the route, which is announced almost as we speak, Daniel. But what can you tell us about the route for next year's Giro?
Yeah, I mean, not that many sort of standout stages, climbs, or certainly not as many climbs of a sort of extreme variety like what we've seen in previous years. No Zoncolan, no Stelvio, but it looks like a slightly lighter route. There is one team time trial, about 17 kilometres, a very, very long individual time trial of 59 kilometres, I think. And the summit finishes, there are a lot of them, but they tend to be on climbs that are not too steep anyway. We've got Sestriere, which comes after the Colle delle Finestre on the penultimate day, but we've also got Cervinia, which is not a particularly difficult climb on the last, well, on the final Friday, I think that is. Madonna di Campiglio, we're going back there, famous, of course, or infamous for being the town where Marco Pantani was booted out of the Giro in 1999. And it looks to me like a move to try to lure more riders who will go for the win in the Tour de France to the Giro, because obviously, you know, there's been a lot of talk about very, very difficult routes, tiring riders out and making it impossible to go for the Giro Tour double. Contador's already said that he wants to do the Giro. He'll certainly be pleased that there aren't too many of those sort of leg-breaking Zonkerland-type climbs. So we'll probably see him. I think we'll see Nibali. And it remains to be seen how Astana are going to get Nibali and Aru to sort of dovetail at the Giro and the Tour. Who's going to be the captain where? I expect Nibali to probably ride in support of Aru at the Giro and vice versa at the Tour. There are still murmurings about Aru's contract, and although he is under contract at Astana, I know some people are fishing around, other teams are fishing around, other managers are fishing around. I think he will stay, but there are people who want to certainly prize him away from Astana for the 2015 season.
Shall we wrap up there, fellas? It's getting a bit, lunch hour is approaching here at the BFI, so we should wrap it up. We've been filmed today as well, and I think this film will be making its way, a little film of the podcast will be making its way onto channels at some point in the future. We'll let you know when. Not that anybody will want to watch it, I'm sure. And it's a shame, Daniel, that you got your haircut scheduled for after the podcast, because you are looking quite long and curly today.
I thought you were going to mention my appearance on Italian TV talking about the Scottish referendum then.
Oh yeah, that's good. He reminded me of that. Yeah, Daniel appeared on Italian TV the day after the Scottish referendum, adding his thoughts in Italian to the Italian. So the Italian public are far more enlightened now about the Scottish referendum thanks to Daniel. What did you actually say?
It was the typical kind of mealy mouth response that I usually give on the podcast on other subjects.
Had you done your research, you know, looked at a map, worked out where Scotland was?
Yeah, I think I mentioned Hadrian's Wall. I think the Battle of Britain. And that was about the extent of my insight.
Daniel, you've got Scottish roots. Your father comes from Hart Hill. And I've never met anyone who comes from Hart Hill, which is right between Edinburgh and Glasgow. There's motorway services there.
Would it be fair to call it the armpit of Scotland?
Certainly windswept. It's on a hill.
I've been.
I don't want to offend our Hart Hill listeners by calling it the armpit of Scotland.
Is it somewhere where people couldn't quite be bothered to get all the way to Edinburgh or Glasgow and they just thought, this will do?
Well, there's nice motorway services there, so you can see the logic for that. Yeah, maybe, Lionel, I really don't have any insight. Maybe if anyone's listening in Hart Hill, they can tell us why they live there. Anyway, shall we wrap it up there? You insulted Coventry last week, your place of birth, Daniel. Now you're insulting your father's hometown. Honestly. Right, well, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you both.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeman.